This is Dolores Cannon again with the Metaphysical Hour. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm sitting here in Arkansas on top of the mountain, and we're waiting for a major ice storm to hit. It's coming in through Oklahoma tonight, and we have been so spoiled. It's been in the 60s, and it's been beautiful. And now it's coming in through Oklahoma, and it's supposed to hit tonight and this weekend. And, you know, we get so spoiled, we're not used to having bad weather. My only problem is I'm out in the middle of nowhere, and I have clients that fly in to have private sessions, and I don't know how I'm going to be able to get in to see them if the roads get icy. But you just got to cross one bridge at a time anyway. All right, I have a very special guest tonight. But before we go, let me give you the toll-free number. The toll-free number, in case anybody wants to call in, is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. And that number is good all around the world. Toll-free. Okay, and I've got a very special guest tonight. It's Linda Mouton Howe. And those of you who are in metaphysics are very familiar with that name. And I've known Linda, Linda, I think it has to be 20 years, doesn't it?
Probably going back to the beginning of Lou Farish's conference in Arkansas, up in Eureka.
Uh-huh, and I've had him on the show, and that, and we know it was 20 years that's been going on.
Well, one of the things, my father's last name is Moulton, so the English with a long O, Moulton, it's not French. And I know sometimes that over the years people have been confused about the pronunciation, but so in honor of my father, it is Linda Mouton Howe, and I have used that three-name as a journalist going back to the end of the 60s when I married Larry Howe, and I had been Linda Mouton professionally, and so that's why the name Linda Mouton Howe I've had for about 30 years.
I apologize.
Oh, no, it's all right, because people that have known me for a long time, they sometimes still think that it's a French name, but it's English, and there was an English astronomer, Mouton, and it turns out that my dad's family goes back through genealogy to him, which I've always found interesting, because since I was 3 and 4 years old, the first thing I asked my parents was, could I have a telescope and a piano?
Uh-huh.
And I have been interested in the sky, in stars, and astronomy since I was old enough to walk.
Oh.
And it is interesting later in my life to find out that one of our bloodlines through my father is the Mouton astronomer in England. So that may or may not explain why I have always had this deep interest in the science of astronomy and never thought that in my career as a TV producer and as a reporter that I would end up doing a story about animals that would take me through Alice in Wonderland's mirror into the incredibly strange world of animal mutilations, which is where, for me, the shift from just straight hard science began in the fall of 1979, going on 28 years ago. And I remember I was director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver, and all of my career up to that point, I had graduated from Stanford University in 1968 with a master's degree in communications, and I was making documentary films for television and doing news, and I had been hired to be director of special projects at the CBS station in Denver. My husband was working for Time Inc. there. And so I was in a very, very normal, standard, let's look at environmental issues, let's look at scientific issues, let's look at national and international political issues. And I was doing live studio shows, documentary films, and news segments when there was an upsurge again in reports of these strange animal deaths in Colorado, in the summer of 79 in the dozens and dozens in which there were no tracks around the animal, no blood on the excision, and I was seeing photographs of these animals and wondering in the summer of 79 what in the world could be taking an ear, eye, the tongue, the jaw flesh, the genitals, and the rectum from animal after animal after animal, and doing it, leaving bodies that looked so precise, so pristine. It was the lack of blood and the lack of tracks, and I wanted to see if I could find out more, and I was in the middle of it was actually a documentary involving actors and music and stage and theater. What a juxtaposition. And when I finished that project and got to the fall and was thinking, what am I going to do next? That, Doris, is when I went to my first, I remember the very first phone call with a sheriff who had been quoted in one of the newspapers. And when I called him up and asked if I could come and see him, that led me to Tex Graves up in Sterling, Colorado. And one of the most amazing days that I have ever spent in my life, which I can tell you more about, but I'm setting up how all of this began for me, and that there was nothing in my life that I thought would take me to the Alice in Wonderland world of extraterrestrial biological entities.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you anyway. I always start off with people telling me their background and how they got into these things, and you just did a wonderful job of setting the stage there.
Well, thank you. It is interesting to me how all this has unfolded.
Therefore, I just wanted to make a remark before I forget about it. There's been a lot on the Internet lately about that horse. Wasn't he the first horse that was found mutilated?
Okay. There's you know how urban legends start. And one of the things in life is when you actually do research, you find that most things that people think, they really are quite different. And in my first book, An Alien Harvest, that came out in 1989, 10 years after I did the television film, A Strange Harvest, I wanted to correct the facts. And the facts are that down in southern Colorado in September, it was September 9th, 1967, there was the Lewis family, and they had a big ranch down below the Sangria de Cristo Mountains around Alamosa, and they found a female, not a male, horse named Lady, not Snippy, and this is the horse that you see with it stripped from the neck up of all flesh. We're talking about a horse that looked like it should get up and walk away, according to eyewitnesses who were there, except that attached to the full and complete body of the horse was the skeleton of the neck and to the head. And that is an unusual case because that is the only animal mutilation case of thousands and thousands now in both hemispheres of the world that has involved the complete stripping of the flesh on the neck and up to the head. And in that particular case, I was fortunate to meet and work with John Altshuler, MD pathologist and hematologist, who unfortunately was hit on his bicycle 3 years ago and ended up passing on.
Oh.
He had the courage to basically say, I'm not going to worry about the fact that this is a phenomenon linked to extraterrestrial biological entities. You bring me the tissue, you bring me the fluid, and he said, and I will do analysis, and you can report it, and I'll put my name behind it. And that's why in the books An Alien Harvest and Glimpses of Other Realities, that John Altshuler, an MD, pathologist, hematologist, a long list of degrees, highly respected in Colorado, had been there with the University of Colorado and other institutions going back all the way into the, I think it was into the mid-60s. And he came forward to help me and told me that I was the only person that he ever told that he was so curious about that horse down on the Burl Lewis Ranch in 1967 that he packed up his wife and young kids and drove down there on a weekend out of curiosity, and that John Altshuler, who did not come into my life until 1986, that's 67 to 77 to 87, that's almost exactly 20 years later, and that I knew about that case, had no idea that there had been a very, very respected professional medical person who had been there. I knew that in some of the reports and some of the people in the valley, they had told me they thought that a doctor had gone there. And the universe works in miraculous ways. It is John Altshuler, who was the medical professional who went to Lady, took some tissue samples and fluid samples, took them back to the University of Colorado, did analysis, came up with the conclusion that whatever had happened to the tissue on that horse in September of 67, it had been hot enough to cause what's called cautery, or a cooking of collagen or hemoglobin at the excision sites. And Dolores, he sat on that information for 20 years because he was afraid, like all the professionals that I have ever encountered, they are so afraid that there will be some kind of stigma, ridicule, if in fact they are involved in research having to do with, we'll call it this field of extraterrestrial biological entities, using the phrase that our own government has in its own leaked documents, but that the government insists do not exist publicly, that they have a policy of denial. Well, John Altshuler, when we finally got together, he knew about my work. He knew that he had all this information about this case in Colorado, and he told me about what he had found, that this was absolutely extraordinary. And he told me, which is in An Alien Harvest, something that had never been published in any of the newspapers, nothing. When he examined the horse, he found that every single internal organ in the chest, in the median sternum, had been surgically excised from that horse.
Oh, it's been taken out.
Had been taken out. That had not been reported at the time, probably because, just like the reporters in the valley, they got the sex wrong on the horse. They got the name wrong on the horse. And now, when you look back, that was really something, because that case involved tripod or deep marks 100 feet from the horse's body. There was charring on bushes away from the horse's body. And one of the things that people lose track of is this was documented. They had a whole bunch of people, including law enforcement, who went out because this was a shocking death and find. 100 feet from where that horse was found, lying in the condition we've just discussed, were the last hoof tracks in that powdery San Luis Valley dust. There were no tracks of any horse anywhere around the body of the horse.
Oh.
The nearest tracks they ever could find were 100 feet away, and you know what? Law enforcement said immediately, whatever happened to this horse, something lifted it up.
That's what I was going to say. It had to have been lifted up and up back down again, or put back.
Exactly. And back then, they weren't thinking the beam technology that you and I and so many of us are now so familiar with, that I know that this government is very familiar, that we're dealing with some kind of intelligence that has a beam. It can lift animals, heavy animals. It seems to be able to lift and lower anything in it. And that would explain what happened to Lady, the Appaloosa mare, on the Burl Lewis Ranch in southern Colorado on September 9th, 1967.
You know, one of the reasons I brought that up, you've probably seen it on the Internet, now they're arguing about the bones. Who is supposed to get the bones? They said the Japanese want to buy them, and they are calling it Snippy, I think.
Well, that's the old... See, people don't even... They don't even correct... they don't do research... They don't know the mistakes that were made in 67, and they keep repeating them. And I frankly, I wouldn't even believe that whatever is being put on eBay is the actual carcass of the original horse. I wouldn't believe it for a second.
Well, they said they dug it up and they don't know. They want to preserve the bones for history and stuff like that.
I wouldn't believe it.
They said something about somebody in Japan offered $50,000 for the bones. And so I'm thinking, why after all these years make such a big fuss over bones that have been buried in?
And I just don't buy it. I think it's somebody's shenanigans.
Somebody trying to get attention or something.
Yeah. Well, they want money. So they're taking a story that all this time has passed, and I would pay a bet that they haven't got the bones of the original horse, and that this is just all concocted.
Yeah, somebody could just sell anybody any kind of bones. They wouldn't know the difference.
That's right.
But you know, that's one thing, Linda, that I really admire about you is that you go out and investigate, and you do have experts, and you get their opinions. I know you, and when they've done the conferences with you, you have veterinarians that come, and you've had laboratory analysis. You really go to the extreme on your research and your verifications, and I admire you for that.
Well, thanks. I mean, that is essentially the way I was raised. This is what we did at school in Stanford. All of my original work for my master's degree was with the Stanford Linear Accelerator in the Stanford Medical Center. And I came out of that master's degree at Stanford very deeply grounded in going after physical evidence and strict forensic interests. And I started working in news at KNBC in Los Angeles, and I was covering everything. And then I was hired to work in the documentary department, and then we had longer form. I can do more in a documentary form than I can in short news pieces.
Uh-huh.
So I liked the documentary world, and that was the evolution. So by the time I got to this amazing mystery of these animals and was sitting down across desks with sheriffs who were telling me about what they had found, and I'll tell you, even though I couldn't get some of them to talk on the record, I'll share tonight with you one of the more amazing firsthand experiences by a sheriff who took this to his grave, but he told me in private. And this was Sheriff George Arnell in Elbert County in Colorado. They had 262 some mutilations in like 18 months back in the mid-70s. And he had file drawers full of these cases. And he told me that they knew that when these big orange spheres that a lot of ranchers thought their barn was on fire until the fire lifted up straight above the barn, and here it was a sphere that looked like reddish-orange fire. Deputies told me it's when those red-orange spheres showed up that we started having mutilations. Well, the Sheriff George Arnell, he went to the local airport, and he told them that what he wanted to do, since he knew that what they were dealing with was coming and going at night, had to be, all of the law enforcement knew that if they're dealing with trackless animals in like the case down in southern Colorado, how in the world do you go from a running horse with running horse tracks, it was obviously running from something, and 100 feet later you find the body. All of law enforcement knew they were dealing with something that was lifting animals up and lowering them back down.
Yeah.
So he wanted to go up into the sky at night, but he did not want any operational lights. So he went to the airport as sheriff of Elbert County and said, I want to be able to fly this Piper Cub, and I want to be able to fly. You'll know where we are by radio, but I do not want us to have any lights on. And they made all this work. And then he also contacted Stapleton. So now the sheriff was sitting in the back left seat looking out the window behind the pilot who is in front of him. To the right of the pilot in the front right seat looking out the right window was the deputy. There are three of them in this Piper Cub with no lights on.
Okay.
And he said, Sheriff Yarnell said, all of a sudden, the pilot screamed. He said, this was a scream. And the pilot has his hand up against the glass and is banging on the glass like this. And the sheriff looks over and he said, I couldn't see anything. It was black as black. And then he said, it hit me. We had been flying over, rural farm country, but there are lights. There are street lights. There are farm lights. You don't fly over solid blackness, not over farm country. There's always a light somewhere. And this was solid, solid black. Zero lights. And then Sheriff Yarnell said, Linda, when it hit me, he said it was like somebody hit me with an electric cord. I realized that the solid blackness had a shape, and the solid blackness below us was circular.
Oh.
And I went from the left window, and I leaned over, and I went to the right back window, and there was the other side of a solid black circle directly beneath our Piper Cub, as if it were glued to our plane.
Mm.
At which point, the pilot said, I'm not staying here. I'm turning our lights on, and we're going back and land. It was the pilot who said this.
He was probably terrified.
He was terrified. So the pilot turned the lights on, and immediately, whatever it was not there. Now, that is a real story from a real sheriff in Colorado, Elbert County, mid-1970s, that underscores the cat-and-mouse high strangeness of the intelligence that law enforcement was dealing with then and are dealing with now when it comes to investigations of the animal mutilation phenomenon.
And you can see why he wouldn't want to tell anybody, because it was so strange, there's no way he could explain it.
He knew they were dealing with something that was, what he told me privately, was extraterrestrial, but he said, you can't use that word, I couldn't stand up. And that I ran into constantly. When I began in September of 1979 to contact sheriffs and to contact ranchers and all of that, I would hear always, no, Linda, I'm not going to stand up in front of your camera. But I'm doing a television show. I don't care. I'm not going to stand in front of your camera and talk about extraterrestrials. I'll lose my job. I heard that a lot.
And the people in town would make fun of you, and you couldn't live there anymore.
Yes, that was their point of view. And the thing about it, Dolores, is here I am, a TV producer, and I'm working on a story that I now know is huge, is a gigantic mystery. People are telling me that it's something from outer space. I can't believe it, but they won't stand up in front of a camera. What am I going to do? Bodies everywhere, increasing in number. Well, finally, in October, it was the first or second week in October of 1979, and the crew and I had been on the road for about 3 weeks in a station wagon from Channel 7 in Denver, and we were moving with events. I would go hour to hour, day to day, through payphones, calling, finding out where was the next this, the next that, and we had literally been on the road with a strange harvest unfolding. And we were down in Trinidad, Colorado, and I knew that Trinidad was in a county that had dozens and dozens of animal mutilations, and I had contacted Lou Girodo. And he had been appointed in about that time, 78 to 79, to be the chief investigator for that district attorney's office on specifically the issue of animal mutilations. There were so many, they assigned him specifically to do investigations. And when I called him up, he said, Linda, I'm just flat out, I'm going out to ranches every day. He said, we're just up to our hips in what's going on with these animals. And he said, but I could meet you at the office at 10 o'clock in the evening. Mm. So the crew and I showed up. We set up our lights. Lou Girodo is sitting across me. The camera is running. And all of this time, 3 weeks in production, I had been asking every single person the same question, who or what do you think is killing and mutilating these animals? And Lou Giraudeau stunned me. He looked right at me, and he said, well, other investigators and I have come to the conclusion that we're dealing with creatures from outer space.
Aha.
And then he went on and explained why. That helicopters hovering over mutilated animals or low and pastures that dissolved into clouds were not terrestrial helicopters. And he had a whole bunch of other reasons. He told me amazing stories that he and another deputy had encountered one of those red-orange fiery lights. They'd seen it split in two, go north-south, come back together, join up as one, and he said, and that red-orange fiery whatever it was went straight down, Linda. The deputy and I, we watched it. It went straight down into the earth and disappeared.
Aha. Uh-huh. Right into the earth.
Right into the earth. And this was an area of pastures where they were having animal mutilations all over the place. And he said, one night, that same deputy and I, we were out in an area where, again, they were having a lot of mutilation reports. And they were in a police car. And that's Giraudeau was the orange light that split in two. Now we're at Deputy Waugh. In George Arnell's Elbert County Sheriff's Office. This is up north of Trinidad, but this is an amazing story. George Arnell was not in the car. His deputy, Bill Watt, was in this their sheriff's car with another deputy. So there's two deputies, and they are out going through the back roads where these pastures have been experiencing mutilations. And all of a sudden, they see one of these red-orange fiery spheres coming right at their car. They screamed at each other, roll out, which was the law enforcement signal that if you have an oncoming anything, you hit the doors and you roll out. You don't even wait to slam on the brake. Now, Bill Waugh says instinctively, he said, I know that I hit the brake. I know that I was slowing the car when I was opening the door and we rolled out.
Uh-huh.
Well, the car, if you can imagine this scene, all of this is happening, as he said, so fast. This object, the car, they're rolling out on the ground. The car is sort of stumbling, weaving, slowing down. This orange-red sphere comes and does a 90-degree turn right at that slowly moving windshield. And they're out there on the ground. And they were looking at each other, and what in the world is happening? Okay, after this thing goes in 90 degrees, they get back in the car. They go down a road thinking that they now know the direction it has gone. So their whole thinking is they're going to chase it. And they come.
Got the nerve.
Yeah, and they come along and see what looks to them something they had never, ever, ever seen in that area, and they knew this land by the back of their hand. It was a red glowing square. And
square.
Bill Waugh says, imagine, Linda, that you're driving on a road and you see this fire engine red glowing square to the right of the road in a grove of trees. What do? He says, you can't pass it. We're law enforcement. We pull the car over. We got out. We walked up to this glowing square, and it disappeared.
Well,
okay.
They got up to it?
They went right up to it, and it disappeared right in front of them, this red glowing square. Now they are really freaked. They've been out there. There's been the red-orange sphere. They nearly crashed, they thought. They rolled out on the ground. They're now going down a road, here's this red glowing sphere, they get out to investigate, it disappears. They are freaked, he said. We just said, we're going home. So they were scared. So they went home, and the next morning, Bill Waugh said, the deputy and I had agreed, we would go back to exactly the place that we saw the red glowing square. And Linda, there were the car tracks. There were our boot tracks, and there were no trees.
No trees.
And he said the deputy and I knew that that red glowing square was in a grove of trees. And now, Dolores, you know where this is headed, is something in the human abduction syndrome that has been reported for 30 or 40 years.
I've gone through a lot of that myself.
We're something in the environment that looks like a merry-go-round is not a merry-go-round. It's some kind of craft. Or people have described, well, there were a lot of ambulances and fire trucks pulled over in the intersection, and I couldn't get through.
Yeah, I've heard it described as emergency vehicles and things like that.
Right, and then under hypnosis, these people have described that the red, blue, and white pulsing lights that they thought were ambulances and police cars were actually a round craft.
Yeah, but what you call a screen memory or an overlay.
Or either manipulation of human minds or the ability to make matter look like something else for whatever is the period of time. And this leads to the high strangeness of all of this. This is where we're talking about that you don't know if the trees around you are real. You don't know if the oil barrel in the corner of the barn is real. And this was brought home to me by a man named Howard Burgess. He had worked as some kind of an electrical engineer at Sandia Labs in Albuquerque. And he had taken interest in the animal mutilations out of a curiosity, not official assignment. And it was Howard Burgess who, hearing about all the mutilations, had gone to Manuel Gomez up in Dulce on a ranch, and who had been having mutilations. This was around 1977, 78. And asked him to get 100 cattle and run them through 7 different frequencies of black light that Howard Burgess brought up. And they put these rods of the black light over the corral chute. And when they ran 100 animals through, they found 7 or 8 that had very odd glowing patches on their neck and their chest. And they were all female, and they were all cows 6 to 7 years old, which at that time in 77 to 78 happened to be the majority of the animals being mutilated. It didn't stay that way over time. It's affected bulls, it's affected steers, it's affected calves, but right then it was 6 to 7 year old cows, and here, that out of the herd, that's what had these glowing patches that were never explained. This same Howard Burgess decided to take a trip up into cattle mutilation country up north in Colorado. He told me he was heading up toward Sterling, Logan County, where there had, like Elbert County, 200 and some mutilations there in an 18-month period. And there's a stretch of road. There's I-25 that will take you north, and then there is a spur that you take off that goes up to Sterling, and paralleling a part of that road is a railroad. And I've been on it many, many times. And Howard said that he's driving along, and on the railroad tracks, in the distance, he sees a boxcar. And he's thinking, that's so odd. Why would a single boxcar be sitting on this railroad track, and what is going to happen? There's going to be a crash. Who should I report? What's going to happen when a train comes through? Why is this single boxcar sitting there? And as he was beginning to worry and thinking, who does he go to report that there is going to be a potential crash, the boxcar rose straight up in the air and flew away. That's like the red glowing square in trees in the night. In the morning, the trees didn't exist, and the red light disappeared in the night.
Yeah, I've had cases like that where people would pull in, like, to a mobile home park, and then they were taken up, but then they went back later. They didn't remember anything. They went back later. There wouldn't be any mobile home park there.
Right.
So it's like things are created just for you to see, maybe to feel comfortable with or something. So, like you said, how do we know what is real and what is not real?
Well, I look at it as disguise. I don't look at it as anything benevolent. I look at it as a way to monitor this earth without humans realizing it.
Yeah, that's me too, because I don't go into the negative at all. I don't have that in my work.
No, I mean, no. I really do think that if there is something choosing to monitor us, manipulate us, mutilate animals, it's nothing that I can trust. I know you've had a much more positive relationship to all this, but I'm not there. I'm in a very, very mistrustful distrust. I don't think that there's anything at all about this phenomena of the non-humans that so far has convinced me that it cares anything about us. I think that there is a use of this planet, a use of us, a use of animals, just like humans are self-serving. It seems to me that the intelligence is quite self-serving.
But you know, one other thing, did you ever find out why was it just that one area of Colorado that had more of these than anywhere else?
Oh, it was all over the state, but you're right, there are high points and there are geographic areas where there's repetitions all of the time.
Uh-huh.
And after 27 years of trying to get to the bottom of it, one thing I've noticed, just recently in Montana, same thing. I was up there with a television crew from Canada to go to where it's very clear this cow was dropped from the sky, bounced on the ground, left a bounce mark, was dropped, mutilated, was not mutilated there. And I went there, and we're out there walking around, and in less than 1 mile from this animal is a nuclear control computer facility.
Uh-huh.
These facilities, these facilities that manage and operate our nuclear missiles have been the targets of UFO activity going all the way back to the very beginning of the Minuteman missile. And that has been testified to by Robert Salas, a lieutenant in the Air Force who was underground.
They talk about radar sites, too, that they see them around there.
Radar sites, military sites, all kinds of things related to our military. And then what I've been reporting for the last 2 years, for the first time, even though the story emerged for me a decade ago, I didn't feel that I had enough data. And more documents and more people have come forward, and that's why I decided I had enough to do this presentation that I have done the summer at MUFON. I was their keynote speaker, and the whole title of it says it, UFO Crash Retrievals, Policy of Denial in the Interest of National Security. And the beginning of this information about our government attacking the DIS technology and the DIS technology retaliating big time came to me from a New Mexico state representative, Andrew Kistner, who during his representation in the government in New Mexico in the mid-90s found that a lot of people that worked at White Sands and at the Naval Research Laboratory that is housed at White Sands and has been since the 1940s, were telling him off the record about their knowledge of this extraterrestrial presence and the fact that we had been trying to attack it since the 1940s with a variety of artillery and then rockets, and that this this technology, obviously controlled by something highly intelligent, would retaliate by taking our V-2 rocket research missiles and destroy them or take them off a course, and that they had photographs. They were telling Andy Kistner they had seen photographs and they had seen film of these white silvery disks pacing along with our V-2 rockets, and instantaneously the V-2 rockets would veer off 180 degrees or 70 degrees, and that our government was definitely in an attack retaliation mode with the disks early on. And then Len Stringfield told me that from his own firsthand information, living in Cincinnati, having been in the Air Force, having seen Foo Fighters himself, having an agreement with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base that he would report to them, and that they had this two-way street for a while. He said, Linda, we did have a standing order to shoot down any disk until we had lost so many pilots that the order was rescinded around 1953 to 54. and that is very consistent with information that Andrew Kistner has received. And this raises an entire huge, huge question. If the United States was attacking and this technology was retaliating, what is the agenda of the non-humans in these disks that we attacked and they retaliated by bringing down power grids, they retaliated by taking our V-2s out of the sky, they retaliated by making sure we couldn't launch nuclear missiles later on, they have retaliated by taking pilots out of planes in the sky. That doesn't mean that the non-humans mean something bad for us. It means they're being attacked and their retaliation is to shut down our electromagnetic equipment and remove pilots from planes in the air, which then makes this government say, we can't keep attacking. What are we going to do next? And today, as we begin 2007, I think that the entire extraterrestrial body of knowledge that this government, with England and Australia, Canada, and its other allies, have gained since the early 1940s, if not going back as early as the 1920s, that it made a decision that the world was not ready to be introduced to extraterrestrials that had technologies that could take animals and people up into disks, that it could kill and mutilate animals with no explanation, that it could do whatever it wanted to on the planet, and was probably involved with our entire biological and evolutionary history on this planet. And that right now, today, this is unfortunate. I think it's wrong that in 2007, that policy of denial in the interest of national security is still in place, still being enforced, while right now in Argentina alone on this planet, since 2003, there have been more than 3,000 animals reported to law enforcement and veterinarians dead and mutilated. There have been hundreds of eyewitnesses in Argentina who have seen the beam technology come down. Animals go up. People go up. Water from water tanks go up. All of this is being reported only in Spanish-speaking local media. And fortunately, Scott Corrales at Inexplicada on the web keeps translating these only Spanish-English local stories. And I once spent an entire summer working with a reporter in Buenos Aires about 3 years ago who had grown up in Wisconsin, was based in Buenos Aires, so he spoke American English, and I could interview him on the phone and everybody could understand him. And he went out for me to a veterinarian, and we did this interview that was on Coast to Coast and on Dreamland. And this was an interview in which a veterinarian is talking to the American homegrown reporter based in Buenos Aires about looking at animals in which the excisions had been cauterized with something that was heating the tissue.
Hmm. Yeah, but these are the kind of things, you know, you don't hear about. But, you know, I know they're true. But let me just throw in something, and I know it's ridiculous, but one of the explanations they always come up with is satanic worship, and they said that that's what it is, and we know it's not anything to do with that.
No. Dolores, I'm glad you brought it up, because back in September, the very first 2 weeks of September 1979, this is starting 28 years ago,
yeah.
The first person in my research outside of the sheriff that I called was the Catholic diocese in Denver. I was known, quite well known, because I was on television there a lot. And I said, I'm Linda Moulton Howe. I'm investigating this animal mutilation phenomenon. Some people say that it's satanic cult. Do you have anybody who is an expert in dealing with satanic cults and all of that? And they said, yes. And this Catholic priest came to the television station, came up to my office, looked at all of the photographs that I had at the time, looked and read some of the newspaper articles, and he said, Linda, I can tell you for sure, there is nothing that you are showing me that resembles anything that we have to deal with in satanic cults. Later on, about 2 or 3 years after I had done A Strange Harvest and it was broadcast, I got a call from a sheriff's office in San Diego, California. And they said, we are dealing with satanic cult operations of professional people between Phoenix and San Diego. And some animals have been involved, and we would like to fly you down here, bring your best files, and we want to have a meeting with several county law enforcement and detectives, and we want you to give us a presentation on animal mutilations because we need the facts. We need to know what is the difference between what we're dealing with and what you're dealing with, and if there is no difference, then you and we are dealing with the same thing.
Uh-huh.
So we went into this conference room at the sheriff's office, and the sheriff said, lay down your files, and I laid out my files with the best photos and transcripts and all of that. And the sheriff and the deputies and the people who were there, they went and they looked at each one and asked me questions and all of that. And after a while, the sheriff turned to me and said, Linda, none of yours looks anything like what we're dealing with.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, show me from my education. What are you dealing with? He said, I would feel irresponsible if I exposed you to what satanic cults do. And I said, Sheriff, if you don't show me, then how am I going to know?
Yes,
so they spent a couple of hours showing me what they were dealing with in Phoenix and San Diego, and I wouldn't describe it for your audience or any audience. It's horrific. It involves blood. It involves things that I have never in my life seen before or since that sheriff's office meeting. But I can assure you with firsthand knowledge, there is not one single animal mutilation investigation that I've done that is anything like what the poor Catholic church and the law enforcement are dealing with in satanic cults.
But yet that's what you keep hearing. They keep blaming
because
the
government wants the media and the public to think they it's like hoax, swamp gas, balloons.
Oh, yeah.
They it's the government that pushes these crazy no fact explanations, praying, hoping that people and the New York Times and the LA Times will buy it, which unfortunately they often do. I sometimes wonder why they are considered to be major media when they never follow the real facts. But the government knows all you have to do is float the word hoax, float the word ridicule, float anything, and that 99% of the world will run from anything in which they think that they might be ridiculed by other people, and the government counts on that. And if you bring up satanic cults, they expect every single person to run the other way. Well, in my case, I was exposed to the facts of the mutilations first. I was at scenes with the animals first. I talked with law enforcement first. I started going to university medical centers and working on trying to understand these strange things that I was seeing. All of that had nothing to do. Government can't spin if you're going out on your own into the field and doing firsthand investigations and talking to real people. The government can't spin that. That's why when Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso met me, and he said, Linda, how did you get so much classified information in your films and your books? And I said, sir, I go out into the field. I investigate. I gather evidence. I talk with people firsthand. And he said, this was Colonel Corso. He said, and you know something? The government doesn't expect any good reporter to do that.
I know, but you know, that's just one of the things. We both of us been around for so long, and I know they always try to discredit our work and everything.
No, I don't find that at all.
I think as long as we're out here,
I don't think my work has been discredited. It stands very strongly.
I know. That's what I mean. After a while, there isn't anything they can do. I don't think.
Well, the physical evidence of the world speaks for itself.
But yeah, they always said if they can't discredit the evidence, they try to discredit the reporter.
Yeah.
But I think it's gotten to the point, if we have a good reputation, they aren't going to be able to do that. We've been around too long.
Well, the evidence speaks for itself. I have said over and over to people who say, oh, mutilations are predator and satanic cult. then and people have come back to me when I've said, go to, and I'll give them sheriff's names and numbers, ranchers' names and numbers. You go and talk to them yourself. Go out on an animal mutilation investigation yourself. Go to a university and take tissue, put it in formalin, and you do the investigation yourself, and then call me up and tell me what you find. And I've actually had people do it and call me up and say, I really apologize, because after what I've learned, I realize that what you're reporting is 100% true.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. You know, we have to go out there and do that. I'm watching the clock, but one thing I want to ask you, Linda, what are you working on now? Are you working on a new book or what?
Well, you know, my website, earthfiles.com, which is a news website in science, environment, and real X-Files, is a daily ongoing news operation. I've been doing it since 1999. This is 2007, so I'm beginning my ninth year, and it is a full-time job in and of itself. And then I do radio constantly. I do weekly radio for Whitley Strieber's Dreamland. I do monthly 2 and 3 hour news segments for Coast to Coast AM with George Noory. I do monthly radio reports for Joe Hu in Chicago. I do magazine articles on a regular basis for 3 or 4 magazines, separate from the work that I'm doing. And I also am producing my own vodcasts and podcasts now on the web at earthfiles.com. I hope some of your listeners will go and check it out. People seem to really appreciate them. And I'm going to continue through Earth Files doing audio reports, radio reports, podcasts, vodcasts, documentaries. And it all complements whatever I also do on the radio, and it all is every single day. Every single day, there are more stories coming to me than I can ever investigate. That, Dolores, is a testimony to how much is happening on this planet that falls into the category of high strangeness. And then if you go out of high strangeness into what is happening to our environment, in global warming, it's huge.
Yeah.
And then if you go into the breakthroughs in science that range everything from what we're discovering about our universe down to what is happening in nanotechnology, I cannot keep up. I have right now, I counted them yesterday, I have 500 different pages of different stories that I still have to go through from before Christmas.
Oh,
and this is just saying to you, I'm working on so many stories all of the time in cycles, and the one I'm posting tonight is fascinating. It is about our sun, and right now there is an argument among astrophysicists. It's very confusing to them. It's very confusing to corporations that have satellites, including the government. They thought by now that they would have a very clear picture of what the space weather was going to be between now and 2012, which is the solar maximum period. And right now, NASA is saying that they think that this solar cycle, which should be starting now and increasing between now and 2012, will be the strongest in 400 years of record keeping. X flares, maybe as many as 160, 180 sunspots, and we're talking about at solar maximum. Why is this important? We now have several thousand satellites that are orbiting our Earth, and everything we do now, we just don't realize how much of our lives are dependent upon satellites.
Yes.
This, if we go in to a major solar maximum that is stronger than anything in the last 400 years, it can fry satellites, it can hurt the International Space Station and astronauts on it, it can interrupt TV and radio over and over, it can bring down communications, it can bring down power grids. And this is the funny thing. The sun is giving mixed signals. They've never seen it before. They don't know what it means. And I recommend for you and for your listeners to go to earthfiles.com In one, about an hour or so, it will be this story on solar cycle 24, the confusion of what's coming next.
Oh.
Intense. It will be up there with dozens of images and a podcast. It's a fantastic podcast. I have gotten the what Stanford University physicists call the singing sun. It's a literal hum, a throbbing hum of our sun from radio that they have now put into audio files. And another is that they went through data going back decades of sunspots that had radio files, and they turned them into audio files. And when they're speeded up, 30-some years of sunspots and the sound of the sun, it sounds like a heartbeat.
Aha.
It's okay. Eerie.
Oh,
it's,
we could go on for another hour. But
yeah, well, go to Earth Files and listen to the podcast on our own sun, and that will be up tonight, so I can't give you a hotter report than that.
Okay, because I'm watching the clock because he's going to pull the plug on me in a minute here. But I'll tell you, Linda, I am so honored for you to take the time to do this with everything else that you're involved in.
Well, Dolores, I mean, it's called sharing about this planet and this universe. It's been my life. And being able to share it on everybody else's broadcast is part of my life, and I'm glad I could do it, and some point we'll do it again.
And I'll see you in April at the UFO conference in Eureka Springs.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the best in this country.
And we've been a regular there for 20 years, and that's where we always meet up.
Yep.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to sign off anyway, and thank you again. It's been a really pleasure to have you on the show.
Happy New Year, Dolores, and Happy New Year to your listeners.
Okay, the same to you. All right, good night, everybody.
Good night.